Chris Hansen. He's got 22, a new career high.
He'll have to shoot from wide out now. It's in the hands of Worthington.
On the buzzer, Mark Worthington.
He's again.
Knock, knock, who's there? Is another episode of the Has Been Hoops podcast. We've had game one of the NBL Grand Final. We've had the conclusion of the WNBL. We've got the NBA going on, and we're about to kick off the New Zealand NBL series with our very own Taranaki. I think I'm saying that somewhat correct. Air's about to start. Chris's team. Chris, how are you, big fella?
Mate, I'm good. It's been massive. You know, it's funny, with everything you've just described, I found myself watching live stats of the NZNBL preseason, and I've never watched a game of basketball from the perspective of an owner, and it's I think it's a little bit early. It's different, early days, but it's been fun catching up with Sammy, understand what he's doing, getting to know what the boys are up to, and the Taranaki Airs are in very good hands, mate. It's exciting times.
Well, I'll say we had a good win in our preseason hit out, and that is without Froling and without Flynn Cameron as well. Still to go to the team. We've had three wins, to tell you the truth. So exciting times, but we will get to that in a second as the season's about to kick off. I want to start off once again with the WNBL and the Flyers winning and LJ winning another championship. What an opportunity lost by the Lynx. That's my first. You come in, you take game one, you lose game two on the buzzer on a missed layup by Annalee Maley that goes down the other end, and Flyers still won. And then it's just an absolute drubbing in game three. But I know you're passionate about it, mate. I'm glad that they made the decision to change the time of the game so it didn't conflict with the NBL game, which was a huge win considering what they went through the other night. But the Flyers seem to have had the best well-rounded team this season.
Yeah, first and foremost, congratulations to the Flyers. I didn't pick that halfway through the season. They looked a little bit one-paced. You know, we spoke about Lauren Jackson's game three in the semi-finals, and I thought she was everything she needed to be in the championship series, and that was just really, really solid and made good choices. And you know what, it reminded me of my very first championship. Just to reflect on that for a minute, when I was with the Southeast Melbourne Magic, we lost game one to the Melbourne Tigers by over 30, I want to say. Found a way to absolutely scrape through game two on a Lenard Copeland missed three that rolled around the rim, and you know, Sam McKinnon rebounded it, got it to Mike Kelly, who made his two free throws, and we blew them out in game three. And as I watched the last 30 seconds of game two, Perth were up all game, and the Flyers stuck around. Perth couldn't knock them out, and you know, the foul on Annalee Maley by Lauren Jackson when Perth were up one and Annalee Maley went to the free throw line to shoot two. And it's nothing that I profess to be an expert in, but you could just tell her body language was so nervous. And you've never seen two more nervous free throws have both missed short. Then, that was when they were up three. The Flyers scored, and then Maley again went and missed a wide open, uncontested layup. They got the ball back, and yeah, every time it just kept compounding. She then tried to go and shoot a turnaround jump shot, which got blocked hard down into the ground, and the Flyers come up with the ball. So, you know what? I heard Annalee Maley's speech after game three, and I'm not sure how I felt for her, but she's going to have a long, long, long off-season with that one. But let's make it about the Flyers. That, you know, it's a sellout crowd for game three. Congratulations to LJ. Congratulations to everyone involved with the Flyers. It's they're a professional outfit, and it was such an even season this year. They've they've found a way to just get those small things right at the right time and play their best basketball when it mattered.
Absolutely. I think you've summed it up really well. And the other interesting part was not from this game, but your news that you ended with the last podcast about the Boomers going to Geelong, that news broke as well, that
did there was it?
Potential of that happening. So,
okay.
Yeah, well, that is a watch this space. Let's move over to game one of the NBL Grand Final Series. Did you go to the game?
No, I didn't. I watched it at the pub in Trentham, but I was at game three of the semis, which we've spoken about, haven't we? Game one was clinical. It was, when I sit and look at Melbourne United, I wonder if their depth is going to be their strength insofar as they just continually throw players at you and overwhelm you with their depth at any minute of the game. Or I wonder if teams are able to hang around, United aren't quite sure who the man is. I thought Chris Golding was exceptional.
Clark was good.
Clark was good. Joe Achul, I thought, was really, really dominant, especially early in the game. But Tassie just never looked like getting within five or seven, after the first quarter. And United scored at ease. And when United can score 100 points, they're going to be tough enough and fresh enough defensively that's going to be really, really hard. And Tassie just had to work harder for their baskets. The physicality of Melbourne United showed out. It's going to be a really interesting one. And on top of that, I thought, I'll dig into this just for a second, but the comment that was attributed, the quote that was attributed to Dean Vickerman about, you guys go and defend the little island and we'll go about business. I just want to go, I didn't see that as disrespectful at all. I thought, they've got a couple, United have a couple of Tassie boys. Tassie are the smaller market. Tassie have what works for them, and United have been a powerhouse since they were put together. And I think that's what teams who are favoured do. They go about their business and try to win championships. I saw it as more of a, here's us, there's you. One of us isn't better than the other one, but here's what we're going for. So the last thing I saw Dean Vickerman's comments was disrespectful. It's going to be interesting to see how the Tasmanian home crowd receives Melbourne United on Friday night.
First off, I'd say that the game one was pretty predictable, especially with Tasmania coming off back-to-back road trips to Perth with a game in Tassie in between, going straight to Melbourne while Melbourne sat in Melbourne after their game three and waited.
Is that easy to say in retrospect, or did you actually find it predictable that they blew them out? Because we haven't spoken about this.
We haven't spoken, but you could ask many of my mates who had asked me what was going to happen in game one. And I said, as much as I love Tasmania as a whole, I think game one is going to be an absolute mauling for the simple fact of the travel component. Yeah, right. Even though they did what they need to do in game three versus the Wildcats, which also I thought was going to be predictable because the sustainability of Keanu Pinder's shooting in game one wasn't sustainable for them to continue to do it in game three. I thought the travel would be just a bit too much and too short of a gap and turnaround for them to be fresh enough to compete against a Melbourne United team that is clearly been led by Matthew Dellavedova and his attitude towards the little things right now. That being said, I totally expect Tasmania to come back firing and win game two in Tassie. And for all the stuff that you just talked about, I think the crowd is going to get into it a lot more than what they have been. I think it's going to go up a level, basically off the back of Dean Vickerman's comment, which I didn't find disrespectful either. I thought it was just saying how it is. And I think part of Scott Roth, what's made him good is he's taken that sort of Gorgian attitude of the underdog, but he actually has a true underdog team to do it with against Melbourne United. And so I think that was Dino's way of trying to shut it down, of saying you can be that, but this is what we are.
You know what? It was interesting when there are two thoughts I've got with the whole thing on top of what you've already said. And the first one is about Scott Roth, is that you can tell it's not fake. He cares about that group and he believes in the message and he takes it to heart. Doesn't make him right, but I believe him. To the best of my knowledge, it's Scott Roth's first head coaching job. He might have had one in the G League for a minute. Somebody will fact check us on that, but it's his first professional, I think, I'm pretty sure.
We don't do facts, Chris.
We deal in memory. the second part was, it was interesting when, you know, when I got back from the Tigers, I said a couple of things my first year back, and we went through a losing streak, you know, in the first year we came back, we ended up winning it. But I did a press conference leading into a game and we were playing Illawarra, and Illawarra were bad back then. And, you know, they talked to the questions about getting back on track and that sort of thing. I said, look, if we don't beat Illawarra, we don't deserve to be in the finals and win the championship. And a lot of people took that as disrespectful. But from where we were and what our aspirations were compared to where Illawarra were, I absolutely believe that if this is the sort of team that roll into our home court and beat us, then we're kidding ourselves with where we're going and we should expect to win this one. But it's really interesting how people pick up that disrespect. I don't think it's intended as disrespect. And certainly the other part with a couple of the boys was, hang on, don't give them any additional ammo. I'm like, hang on, if we come out ready to play and we've got that same amount of ammo, we're fine. We should be able to match intensity and effort every game. We shouldn't have to depend on something else to increase our level because we should be at maximum levels anyway. And I think that's where Tassie should be. It's going to be a fascinating one. It's, you know, if Tassie aren't ready to go at the start, it could go the other way too. It could be a sweep. It's going to be a really, really important game, clearly.
It's funny, without notice, I'm pretty sure that you feel like the biggest matchup for the both teams are in the centre with Magne and Lee versus JLA and Haporti.
Not really.
What do you think the biggest matchup is?
I think the most important players for United are actually Luke Travers. I think Luke Travers matching up with
Jack McVay
is critical. And I think it's more about Jack McVay than Luke Travers. I think it's limiting him.
This is a little plug, but I spoke to NBL.com and they said what was the most important matchup. And I truly believed it was the Travers versus McVay matchup. Just because the simple fact that we know that if Jack McVay really gets his confidence up, the team sort of, you know, levels his energy and what he brings to the table. Equally so, I think that Luke Travers has had a fantastic season, his first one coming from Perth. And we've seen so much inconsistent basketball from Luke Travers over the years that this is the first time that we've seen a consistent good year from Luke Travers, and I think that McVay's going to have a very, very big game too. And I dare say, if Tasmania are to win it all, Jack McVay will be the MVP of the grand final series.
The second most, and I agree, the second most important player, and might not be the right term, but the guy that I think is absolutely critical for United if they are to win this thing is Ian Clark. I don't think Tassie can match him off the bench. And I think Ian Clark is the one guy, even more so than Haporti, more than Kyle Bowen, more than the other guys. He's the one guy that allows United to rest their studs and get genuine impact. He may be the most skilled player on the team, maybe, arguably. I just don't think Tassie can match him. And if it gets into down the fourth quarter and there's a couple of minutes left and you're looking for fresh legs, which hopefully you're not, But the ability that Ian Clark has to continually apply scoreboard pressure and be able to create his own shot through the game, I just think he's critical for what United are doing. And he's been playing great.
Before we move off the NBL, I just want to touch on the two teams that lost in the semi-final, so Illawarra and the Perth Wildcats. I'll start with Illawarra. I sent this tweet, and I'm pretty sure I didn't say this last time we did the podcast, but we're old and we lose our memory, so I could have. But Tatum, to me, is Joey Wright 2.0. Did I say this last podcast?
No, you didn't. Keep going.
So I tweeted this. Same philosophy, tempo, play hard, up and in defense. Have a go-to guy, which they did in Gary Clark, and a few dudes with attitude. Can't all be nice guys. Hold them accountable, give them confidence. It's a good recipe for the NBL. And when I watched Tatum, I was like, this is literally like Joey Wright coaching again. Just that this guy, Tatum, I believe, has had really good talent at his disposal. And if they can bring back majority, I think they need to look at getting someone different for Justin Robinson. But if they can bring back majority of this team, Froling, Clark, even Tyler Harvey, if you can get him naturalised sooner or later.
Only if he's naturalised. I was going to say, I wouldn't bring back Harvey as an import. Yep.
Yeah.
Hickey,
like there is a good nucleus there for them to grow from.
I agree. And they're going to be targeted from the Sydney Kings with some of the players Gorge has coached. And I think that Tatum, I agree. I hadn't thought about that as you said it. I thought, yeah. The other thing with that, and as you describe it, I think that exact personality as a coach, you say it suits the NBL. I think it suits the NBL small market teams. And I would put Adam Ford into that category as well. I think he's a very similar personality. I think he may very well, perhaps we've seen it. He didn't work in Sydney, but he worked in a small market. Justin Tatum may not work in a big market with high salary, high expectation, but I think those guys get the most out of that underdog mentality. And now credit to him. And, you know, it's a very different story for John Riley. He's got that other level of expectation. He's got a higher salary cap at his disposal. He's got a home crowd that is used to winning championships and making semifinals. So for them, Perth would look at this season as a failure, where Illawarra look at it as a success and something to build on. So it's going to be really interesting to see what Perth do. I don't think they can bring Usher back. I'm going to be fascinated to see if Jesse Wagstaff sticks around or retires. They need to get young, they need to get athletic, and they need a genuine second option for Bryce Cotton. Now, if Bryce Cotton gets naturalised, I think a lot of people just tend to think that the Perth Wildcats will be right up there with the Sydney Kings and Melbourne United again. But you still don't get more money to spend on those three imports, so you still have to get lower-level imports. It's going to be a fascinating roster build at the Perth Wildcats, because they will expect to continually get better. And I like Scott Roth's comments, and clearly he's got a soft spot for Perth, having, I only found out, been recommended for the Tassie job from Jesse Wagstaff, but cut his teeth as an assistant with the Perth Wildcats. He talked about, and forgive me for getting the quote wrong, but, you know, John really climbed out of the hole that everybody was trying to bury him in. I really like that analogy, that we were the same. We thought that John really was struggling, and he stuck true to what he did, and he did climb out of a hole that a lot of the NBL was trying to bury him in. And I think the Perth Wildcats had the biggest shovels. They were gone, and they wanted him gone. So it is actually a credit to what he was able to do in the second half of the season. But I guess the biggest difference is the lens at which you're looking through those, the lens in which you look at those two teams' semi-final exits through. They're probably closer than what you think, but Illawarra seem to be a more positive story because of the lens we're looking at them through.
I agree. I think the roster makeup going forward, and Danny Mills has got an interesting choice in how he's going to go about his business. Obviously, Jordan Usher's not going to be there. Saar's not going to be there. I dare say Jesse's probably not going to go around again. And then you've got the Webster brothers, whether you keep with this experiment, but I know what you're going to say, that you can't. And you know what? I was pretty happy with the way that Ty Webster adapted to his role this year as a defender, more so than trying to be a scorer and all that. I think he found his position. They've also got Ben Henschel that sits behind him that he's got outstanding upside that needs to start getting minutes as we go through this. And I think you need to be able to slide Pinder down into the four spot and have an actual legit big that can play against your Magnays, your JLAs and all that if they want to and Sam Froling if you want to contend for a championship.
Ty Webster, one thing I'm not sure if we mentioned it, but we probably did last episode, but I love the way Tassie defended Perth. They quite literally defended like crazy, but at the same time picked their poison. And they absolutely dared Ty Webster to shoot the perimeter, to shoot either the three or the long contested two. They made him uncomfortable by leaving him open. And I think when it comes down to it, yeah, I thought Corey Webster proved that player that we knew years ago is still in there somewhere, but it's high risk, high reward. It's going to be interesting to see what they do with both of them. I'm actually looking forward to seeing both of them play over in New Zealand in the off-season. We'll get a close look at what they're really like when they're given the keys a little bit more in a league where they're able to express themselves a little bit more. But they've both got steps to take.
Before we move over to the NBA, again, without notice, I'm going to throw it to you just to give us a little preview of the New Zealand NBL and what we can expect this season. Obviously, we know that the Ayers is our team. We're going for the Ayers. We love the Ayers. As the number one ticket holder in WA, I can't wait to watch them online this year. But who are some of the teams that we should be looking out for this season? I know the Saints are typically put in a strong team.
Auckland will be tough. You know what? It's a really, really sneaky, strong league. And it's such a cliche, but, and I've mentioned it here, we've recruited players who want to get somewhere and use the NBL in New Zealand to grow an element of their game or rediscover an element of their game. So, you mentioned the preseason we went 3-0, but other teams were more depleted than what we were. So we don't read too much into that. What I love about the preseason was Sammy got to go on the road with one of our assistant coaches, a lot of our players that he hasn't known historically, get to know them on and off the floor. I think that sort of a trip's really, really important, especially for a first-year coach at any club. So, Sam Froling rolls in at the end of this week. I'm sure we'll miss Flynn Cameron for our first game, our first two games on the road. We may not get Flynn until our first home game on the 13th of April, depending on how long this series goes with United. But I really, really have been looking internally, not externally. I'm fascinated. You know what? I'll say the highest risk, highest reward player on our roster is Carlin Davison. And so for those Aussie NBL fans, he's a development player at the Taranaki Ayers. He's a 6'6 athlete who doesn't shoot the three ball great yet. And, a lot of people around basketball would probably describe his game as erratic. His highlights are incredible. And then as you look back and you think, all right, who would be the perfect person who's seen the world through his lens to coach him? Sam McKinnon. So I am absolutely fascinated to see how Sam coaches Carlin, how Carlin responds, because I know Sam will be tough on him because he gets him and Sam gets what his upside is. One thing about being a local player in a small market team is oftentimes there's a leniency afforded to you that isn't afforded to other players of less ability. But, one of the qualities of all the best coaches I've been around is that they coach their most talented players the hardest. I'm not quite sure that Carlin's had that over the last couple of years yet. So I'm really, really excited to see what lies in store with Carlin. Of course, I could go on the same sort of spiel with all of the players, but that one's probably the one that I'm fascinated in most.
I think most NBL fans will be most fascinated by Mitch McCarron and what he's able to do this off-season. Obviously, he's had a couple of tough years in Adelaide. He's trying to rediscover his confidence.
I don't think it's confidence. I think it's role. And it's a really, really interesting one. And I'm actually yet to speak to him. And Sam recruited Mitch. And quite ironically, I was sitting at a pub with Sammy when Daniel Moldovan called us and told us we had Mitch. And we thought we were no chance because we know, I don't think he'd mind us saying Mitch chose to come to us when he had larger offers somewhere else. And that's a credit to him. And we're going to do absolutely everything we can. But the way I could, probably the most insight I can give you is that Sam, when he was speaking to Mitch, is recruiting Mitch McCarron from 4 years ago, not Mitch McCarron the last two. And everyone wants Mitch McCarron, the aggressive, the boomer, the Damian Martin type rebounder, facilitator who can also score the ball. So I would expect to see a much more aggressive Mitch McCarron that reminds the Australian NBL teams what he's capable of and is able to step into a role, whether it be with Adelaide or another team, but to grow that confidence in him being able to deliver the type of performances and offensive output that he was a few years ago before he found himself in the system he's been in the last couple.
While I think about it, the outside the finals NBL and relating to New Zealand is Sam Menenga got bought out for his last year of the Taipans to go back to New Zealand and sign with the Breakers, which, I think that would spell the end of Mathiang in New Zealand, I would assume, or Dane Penaud, one of the two. But
Dane Penaud.
I'm a big fan of this guy, and I feel like he has a much bigger upside than what we saw this current season in the NBL.
So it was really, really interesting. Sorry to cut you off, but my philosophy has always been to recruit local talent first. Our absolute two highest priorities were Flynn Cameron and Sam Menenga over other players who you would assume were higher than we had Sam Menenga. We were told that Sam wasn't available. He's going to go through the NBA draft process, the camps, all that type of thing. And we were a little bemused when he ended up signing for another team because we were told he was unavailable.
And he signed with the team that's got Sam Grogan as the head coach, the Fire, assistant.
And we understand that. But it didn't probably, when he then was released before playing a game to go and play in Europe, we felt a little more comfortable in the conversations we'd had around him. But I agree. I love his touch. I think he shoots a three well. We had him rated higher than Sam Wartenberg, where others had Sam Wartenberg rated higher. I believe he's a better competitor. I think he's got better upside. If I was to go in and ask for a consistent competitor with a similar level of skill, I would take Sam Menenga over Sam Wartenberg. So, yes, I agree. The Breakers got a good one. They've paid for it if they've bought his contract out, but we clearly rate him very highly and we very much asked about him and pursued him quite strongly when we first took over the Taranaki years.
Mate, let's switch over to the NBA. Well, I feel like it's almost on repeat with Boston. Did you see Kyrie Irving's game winner today? Just out of
curiosity. That was one of the best game winners I've ever seen. One of the most skillful deliberate game errors I've ever seen.
Yeah, that was so good. That's not on our run sheet. Why is nobody talking about New Orleans Pelicans, Chris?
This is one we did put on the run sheet. And my short answer is I don't know. Maybe it's because Zion's not fat and not injured anymore and he's actually just contributing in a, you know, in a way that you would expect a very talented teammate to contribute in without feeling the need to be the number one guy. Brandon Ingram's usage is down and other teammates are getting involved, but they're never mentioned as a top four seed or a top six seed or a playoff lock in the West. But I think they are. And I've committed to watching more of them over the next couple of weeks because the reason we wrote it on the run sheet was because we're as guilty as anyone else. If you said, what do they run? What do they do? Where do they go? We don't know. And that's the dilemma, isn't it? That we get so caught up in talking about the big market teams and the high profile players. We want to talk about Zion Williamson when he's out and eating hamburgers, like we want to talk about Ben Simmons when he's out. But a little bit like Kyrie Irving, you know, I was listening to a podcast today that said this is the longest stretch that Kyrie Irving's ever played without missing multiple games. And it's quiet Kyrie. We haven't heard from him. I think the same applies to Zion Williamson. We haven't heard from him and he's given the public no fodder to go at him with. So from the limited amount of watch them, there seems to be a professionalism about them and a way that they're going about their business that's really, really impressive and enough to make me want to watch them as much as anyone as the regular season closes out, because I think they can, I think they could finish top four with the Clippers having the injury concerns and not playing great, but they're a chance to be a top four seed and have home court advantage in the first round.
Well, as it stands right now, the top six in the West, OKC on top of the West, Denver, Minnesota, Clippers, New Orleans, and Sacramento. Now, between New Orleans to Oklahoma City, so 1 through 5, there's only a 6-game difference in between there. I don't think the 10 is going to change the way that it is. So Dallas, Phoenix, Golden State, and the Lakers roll out the 10. The Houston Rockets are 4 games behind. LA, as it stands currently, they're the only one within shooting distance of them. So I think the West is pretty much locked in 1 through 10 already as what they're going to be. The East, I think they're almost locked in, the only team being Brooklyn that could potentially get into the top 10. I must admit, I watched a Charlotte Hornets game the other day and I wish I would have burnt my eyeballs.
I was about to say, please don't say something good here, right?
No, they are horrendous. And if I looked at their team, I dare say a Melbourne United could beat them right now quite easily, or a Tassie Jack Jumpers, because the garbage that they had on the court, they were just hard to watch, to say the least. I really, the NBA is pretty much locked in at the moment. How about all defensive team criteria? What do you think the criteria should be? Do you think it should be stats? Do you think it should be an eye test? How do you think the defensive team should be selected?
Here's the thing, is that everybody will talk about points per possession and stops in on ball, all of the analytics they'll go with, but measuring or selecting an all-defensive team, I mean, you're a great defender your whole career, and one of the things that would do your head in, I'm guessing here because we haven't spoken about this, you can do an incredible job on a team's best player and the ball will swing and it'll swing again and they'll shoot some bullshit contested three, which will give them a 3-point possession, which reflects on your statistics in your attempt to win a defensive player of the year. There's got to be an eye test as well. You've got to also, you can't be punished by having a Daniel Johnson on your team. You know, it's like playing 5-on-4. If you're, no one at the Dallas Mavericks is ever going to win a defensive player of the year because their stats won't line up when they're playing with Luka and Kyrie. But for all intents and purposes, Josh Green or someone like that may very well consider themselves to be an elite defender, but it will never show up statistically. So I still think you've got to run your eye over and see the work that they're doing. You've got to look at their teammates and evaluate whether or not they're witches hats or capable defenders. But the second part of that becomes, I suppose, as a big, if you're a big and you're playing, let's just continue with the Dallas Mavericks scene. You've got Luka and Kyrie and you're defending straight line drive. And you're trying to defend Anthony Edwards at the rim on a straight line drive, who's got the ability to go and dunk it on you for half a step late. Or if you jump, dish it to your guy because you've had to commit to help so heavily. You can be an incredible defensive player with poor teammates and never be rewarded as that. So, I don't know. I think we've got to get away from looking at who's got the most blocks in the league and who's got the most steals in the league, because you'll probably find the guy with the most steals in the league probably gives away the most uncontested layups as well, because they've shot a passing lane and let the other team go 5-on-4. So, I don't know. I think that's got to be one that's deliberated on by basketball players and throw the stats out the window. Tell me how far off, Mark. You might completely disagree here.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree. I think stats only tell a little bit of the story at the end of the day. And you're right. There's a few teams where you're surrounded by guys that can't play defense, so your stats might actually look better. Because you're having to contest more or cover more than someone else that is playing in a defensively sound team. I do like the fact that a lot of the guys that have won the awards have been surrounded by good teammates and they're the anchor of a good defensive team. I don't think you should be punished because there's other decent defenders around you, but I think if you're known as the anchor point, like a Jared Jackson Jr. When he won it, I thought he anchored a good defensive unit.
A good defensive unit. He didn't have any of those liabilities, I don't think, on the team.
Probably Ja Morant was the only one that would give him a straight line from time to time.
But at the same time, he'll go and, yeah.
But Desmond Bane could hold his own on the defensive end. Obviously, Dylan Brooks is a solid defender. There was guys around him that could definitely guard the yard around him. I don't know what the answer is to that, but it has to be more than just stats. I know that.
Hey, speaking of guys who perhaps have a reputation of struggling defensively that we love, I've been rapt to see that Patty Mills has found a role in Miami and seems to be really embracing it. I don't care about that old Heat culture and Boomer's culture crossover thing. I think that's a load of shit. I just think Patty Mills has found a team that values his skill set. It's been really fun to watch as a basketball fan, but as also as someone, maybe even more importantly, who wants to see Patty Mills ready to go when the Olympics roll around in a few months' time. And it's just been really pleasing. So rap for him, rap for the club that they're playing. You're maybe grateful for the Heat for playing him, but let's see what happens when it really gets to nut cutting time and we roll into the playoffs. And
let's see what the Heat are big on their defensive principles, right, especially come finals time. I think he still has a role to play as a shooter. And Duncan Robinson has definitely found that he needed to play more defense for him to get minutes on the court. Remember that stretch where he signed that big contract, but it wasn't playing defense, so he sat on the pine. Now Patty is finding his feet offensively with him, but will need to find a way to get on the court through the defensive end of the floor.
100%. Mate, that's about all we had on the list. We didn't come up with the Hotel Trentham six-pack. We drank that this week. Speaking of the Boomers, Ben Simmons is out. Fucking big surprise. Actually, let me ask you one. There's one beer left in the six-pack. I haven't drunk it yet. Should Will Magnay be an Olympian this year? We're small. So we've got
Duop Reith, who is playing good minutes and showing that he's serviceable, and we've got Jock Landale currently holding that position down.
Do you think Duop's a four internationally though, with the way he shoots the ball? Because
probably
he's only
can be.
He's only 6'10".
Yeah. I mean, and then you go to, is it Will Magnay or is it Joe Lualachul? Do we need more scoring?
You haven't said Nick Kay.
Well, Nick Kay's a four man. He's not right. A five man.
There you go. So we're talking straight five, and then you've got Jack White. Do you think Magnay's the best rim defender that we've got?
We've got Xavier Cooks as well. So once you start adding people up.
But we get 12.
Yeah.
So is he different enough as a rim defender and hard roll guy? I don't think we have that hard roll guy who finishes above the rim and can protect the rim. Is he different enough?
I think he is, and that's pretty much what Bainesy bought when we won our bronze medal, was that hard screener, roller to the basket. There is definitely a world for that in international basketball that we don't currently have on the Boomers team.
I think Will Magnay needs to be. I absolutely think the more I continually talk myself into it, Will Magnay needs to be on that aeroplane going to Paris to represent Australia at the Olympic Games.
Are you a selector for Gorge?
Absolutely not.
Call Jason Smith up and ask the question. Mate, that will do us for now. Thank you for your time again. Hope everyone enjoyed. If you did like us, give us a thumbs up, a like, whatever you do on this sort of platform. Chris usually says this. I don't say this shit.
Keep going. You're not on social media. Just really quick, wrap up with all the Instagram and the Facebook stuff.
Yeah, make sure you're
on Facebook.
Yeah, just like MySpace, make sure we're in your top friends. We'll speak to you next time. Thanks, big fella.
Catch ya.
Knock, knock.